I fully appreciate, I'm sure, the interest that is manifested, and especially by you young men, for whom these services are most largely held. Possibly some of the rest of you won't appreciate what is said as much as some of the line that might be discussed. But I want to talk to these young men especially this morning on some matters that I have observed and think would be practical and beneficial to them. First of all, preaching the gospel is the greatest work ever undertaken by man, the greatest challenge that has ever come to us. In so doing, we're speaking and dealing with man not only as he was, but as he is, and as he shall be. And what we have to say transcends the realm of time and timely things, and launches us out into the eternal depths of the boundless beyond. When you ask for our authority to preach, you might say it was the commission given by Christ, but I wasn't there when Christ gave that commission. None of you were present. Nor has he ever appeared to any of us as he did to Saul, charging us so to do. But the arrangement has been from the first that the gospel was to be handed down. And hence, hear Paul's statement to in 2 Timothy 1. Thou therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus. And the things that thou hast heard of me, the same things commit thou unto faithful men, able to teach others also. Our authority to therefore comes from Christ through Paul and other apostles who received their inspiration from high heaven. Hence, Paul said, Timothy, I charge you to preach the word and to continue the things that you've learned, knowing of whom you've learned them. Hence, the principle is to hand it on down from one generation to the other unto a certain type of men, and here they are, faithful men, able to teach others also. Now, I think that in those two statements, you have the qualifications of a gospel preacher. First of all, let him be faithful, loyal, and true to God's word. Let him stand four square for the things that are penned by inspiration. And then let him cultivate that natural ability that he may have, that he may be able to transmit unto those who hear him that which he has in his mind. Now think of it. There are lots of brethren just as faithful and loyal to God's book as any preacher dare be. Plenty of them. But they're lacking in the second qualification. When they get up, their thoughts sit down. And hence they can't get the two together. On the other hand, there are men that are wonderful good speakers. They are eloquent, can hold an audience spellbound. They are mighty in the scriptures, and they're quite entertaining. But they are not faithful to God's word, and hence they should be let out. One of the finest young preachers that I have ever known, I think, was a classmate of mine, and he and I together held some meetings. One did the singing, the other did the preaching. We were in a good meeting in a West Tennessee town, and this brother had preached. A good old sister told me, said, Brother Hardeman, when that man gets in the pulpit, he ought never to get out. And when he gets out, he ought never to get back in. And of course, you catch on to what she meant by a statement of that kind. I'd love therefore to encourage you to study that you may be properly qualified, not only with your degree of loyalty to God's word, to stand for it regardless of public sentiment or anything of the kind, and then, young men, that you study that you may be able to get across in the simplest way possible that which you have in mind. But first of all, get something to tell. Way back yonder, a young man entered Old Nashville Bible School, and in planning his course, he asked Brother Lipscomb if he didn't think that he ought to take expression. Brother Lipscomb said, "No, not now. I think first you ought to get something to express, and then study expression later on." Now, if you have your ideas centered upon how to appear and how to express matters at the very beginning, I think you better reverse the gear. First of all, learn something, know something, not only about the Bible, but the Bible itself and the common things of life before you everywhere. And then, young men, study and cultivate the ability to think independently. It's all right to accept what is said and to get ideas from the other fellow, but think about that and be able to put matters together. I'd really doubt if I ever had an original thought in my life. And I say that in all candor. But what I know, be it little or somewhat of the kind, I've gained it from others. But after having read what they said, I've then kept that thing and revolved it and rotated it over and over in mind and thought about if I could add something to it or if I might eliminate something from it and let the thought be my own and therefore not a copyist by any means along line of that kind. It is said of one of our young preachers that he was quite a student of the other fellow's sermons and committed them to memory. And one time out in a meeting in a brush arbor, he got up to speak, by the way, and said to them that he was delighted to see such a splendid company present, evidencing by that fact their interest in what he had to say, and that we had a very fine crowd, that both the lower floor and the balcony was filled to capacity. And yet, under a brush arbor, they didn't have a balcony. But he was repeating what somebody else had said along lines of that kind. Now, of course, you don't want to be that. It's all right, young men, to have some ideals and some characters that you appreciate. I said to you, one of the talks already made, that two men were the greatest inspiration to me as speakers that I've ever known. One of them was Mr. Bryan, who died before you got here, by the way, back in 1925. And the other was our lamented Senator Edward Carmack of Tennessee. I followed Mr. Bryan wherever he spoke within 100 miles, and always well paid. And the beloved Carmack was a wonderful speaker and had every phase of that which was appealing that I thought ought to be duplicated on down the line. Hence, pick out just those preachers, by the way, that serve to impress upon you a fine manner of presentation of things round about you. And then, after think along that line, select your subject about which you expect to preach, and let that be simple. Don't be ashamed to preach, for instance, on the Great Commission, on Philip and the Eunuch, on baptism, or any other topic of Bible interest. And don't get so smart, by the way, that you think, well, that's an old theme, and the old preachers preached on that, and I've got to preach on something different. And the chances are it'll be quite different too, by the way. But you'd better stay with that. And then when you take a text, don't try to preach it the next minute or the next day, but let that text be in your mind. Think about it. Develop it. Let it get ripe. Just like a tomato that you put up and wait for it to ripen. And get other thoughts that cluster around about it. And then when you get ready to speak, why, stick to the subject. I think the greatest fault among gospel preachers is simply this. They get the wrong idea from a Bible statement. You know, in Acts 8 and 4, the record says that Jerusalem church was scattered abroad and they went everywhere preaching the word. Sometimes we take a text and do likewise. After our text, then we go everywhere preaching the word. I've heard it said of one of the best preachers and most popular in Tennessee that what he said was absolutely fine. He was entertaining, quite eloquent, and attractive in all manners. But when he got through, you could name what he said one thing just about as well as another. He covered everything in general, so it was said, and nothing in particular. Did you boys ever go fox hunting? If not, you missed a whole lot, by the way. I know of no sport more interesting to me than to get with some old fellows, by the way, with a pack of walker dogs and go out upon the ridge some night and bear wait till they strike trail and hear them after a while get warmed up and come over the hill singing in the sweet by-and-by with every fellow saying, "My dog's in front," and so on. Big tales told. But sometimes an old hound will start out after a fox and then he'll take off after a rabbit and get away off on a sideline and never come back to the main track again. Well, preachers sometimes are tempted to do that. You'll preach along a certain line and happen to think of something, and if you're not very careful, you'll switch off and leave the main thought altogether. Don't violate the law of unity in the discussion of the subject that you have before you. Stay with, therefore, the text that is presented. Now, another thing that I may differ with a lot of you who are present regarding it. My suggestion is, young men, that you accept the translation of the Bible as it is. Either King James or the Revised Version. And think about it for a moment. There were 47 scholars selected for their linguistic ability, for their knowledge of Hebrew and of Greek, the original languages of the Old and the New Testament. They labored for quite a while, and as a result, they brought out King James Version. Then later on, 101 men were selected to form the Revised Commission. They set to work, by the way, and spent quite a while in that. And who were they? Men of ability, men of renown in the ability to know the language of the writings of the apostles themselves. Hence, 101. Now add, that makes 148 scholars, with all deference to any of you, teachers and all. I doubt if you'll ever make the record as a scholar in Greek or Hebrew, as did those who were selected to pen these words into our language. And I want to tell you, men, what is true about it, as I think. There is a disposition on the part of so many that graduate from college and come up with a smattering of Greek to tell the audience, now, here's what it says, but the Greek says this. The tendency of that is to weaken the faith of the people in the Bible. I had a discussion once in Nashville on the music question. And my opponent, a very fine man and a learned man, but forevermore was rejecting or at least substituting for what the Bible said, what the Greek said, and thus the idea presented. I need capital, I think, of that. If that disposition prevails and you convince the audience that the writers missed it on this point, how do they know but they missed it somewhere else? Hence, I'm not one of that kind that all the time spouting out what little Greek I may know. God knows I know little enough about English, much less about Greek. And while larger ships may venture more, smaller boats should stay near shore. From the English book itself, this Bible, any man can learn what to do to be saved, how to live a Christian life, and how to reach heaven when he comes to the close of his earthly career. And I think, therefore, it's good sense and good suggestion for you to shy clear of things of that kind. Now, I know that there are places where substitutions or synonyms might be used, but there is the statement in the Bible here that's deceptive. And if I'll do just what it says, all will be well. Of course, I prefer King James because I learned it first of all, and I think it has superior advantages. The most beautiful English on the face of God's earth is found in King James. The most dignified language that man ever heard is in this Bible. It has that solemnity and that dignity about it as I think none others possibly do. And I don't like to hear some preacher talk about God and say, now, you said, Lord, that you'd forgive us our sins, we'd confess them, and so on. Talk about God as you. Well, of course, that second person, I understand all that. But looks to me like that's bringing God down to the common of mankind. You know, there are four or five styles of expressing ourselves. For instance, there's the ordinary style, like I'd say this. I walk the floor. Over you. And hence that's the ordinary style. Well, the progressive style, I am walking the floor. And then the solemn style, the emphatic first, I do walk the floor. And again, thou walkest the floor. Now, it just occurs to me that the best I can do is refer to Jehovah as thou, thee, thine, rather than, Lord, now you know what you said about it, and we appreciate the fact that you died for us. That's getting down in the common realm, and my suggestion is, and you can take it for what it's worth, don't get in that habit, but maintain that dignity and that solemnity that ought to characterize all of us. Furthermore, I know that there are expressions that are not what we now have. Paul said, for instance, to the Romans, I purposed to come unto you, but I was let hitherto. Well, that doesn't have much sense to it, so I have to learn just what's meant by that. I was hindered. And let us provoke one another. Well, provoke now means to stir up the anger in a fellow. And it's better to say, let us call forth one another, and so on, along that line. Then I know good and well that in this King James, for instance, our Father, which art in heaven. Well, in more modern times, which doesn't refer to persons. Who refers solely to persons? Which refers wholly to things? That refers both to persons and things. And it's better, therefore, and more euphonious to say, our Father, who art in heaven. And whenever reference is made, use matters of that kind. Well, There are some other things that I had in mind, and this is one talk that I made just a few notes regarding, and that's unusual for me to do a thing of that kind. I've never been located within a church in my life. I am a dislocated preacher. Someone said, you ever have charge of a church? No, and I'd be sorry for the church if I ever had charge of one. God knows it has suffered. But if you are a located preacher, to which I have no objection whatsoever, I think there are some things that ought to be studied along that line. First of all, the located preacher ought to learn the congregation. I'm sure you accept that. The older ones, he ought to refer to by their surnames. The younger ones, all right to speak of them as John and Joe and George and Henry and Mary and Martha and Susan. Not Susan Hayes. So on down the line. Then if I were a preacher located, I'd think it wholly out of order if I were to try to take charge of the church and speak of it as I have heard some gospel preachers, my church and my congregation. Just think about statements of that kind. You know, that has given rise to the objection that is valid sometimes about the pastor system. Now, who's to blame for that? Well, simply the preachers themselves. When they speak after that manner and talk about my pulpit, and I'm going to fill my pulpit next Sunday, and my theme shall be this, and then some great high-sounding, catchy expression. Well, I wouldn't do that if I were a preacher for anybody's congregation. I'd let the elders run the church. I'd not even meet with them unless they invited me. And there to be holy in an inferior capacity. And I'd learn to speak, as I said, of the older ones as brother so-and-so and sister so-and-so and the younger ones by their names. I've been invited time and again and have responded to calls to speak before clubs. One time up at Jackson, Tennessee, short distance from where I live, I think it was the Rotary Club that I was to address. And before the time came, there were young men in it, scarcely out of their teens. And then I remember old Dr. Savage, a Baptist preacher and a professor who had been teaching school for more than 50 years. And this young upspurt, that's what an old Negro woman called an expert, upspurt. He referred to him and he came in, this young fellow said, "Hi, George." And I just thought about dropping to the floor, the idea. Is that the nature of things? That you just barely able to sprout baseball mustache, 9 on the side. And yet, refer to this old man past 80 years and call him by his first name as if he were on a common level. Now, Rotary Club or whatnot, I wouldn't do a thing of that kind. And I don't think the world likes any such. Therefore, have that regard for your fellows and don't nickname your congregation and don't have abbreviations about them. I know in schools many times do that, boys. I'm perfectly familiar with that. But that's rather a bad habit. The young teacher went out, by the way, a young lady, to open up her school. And the pupils were gathered around about him, and of course the first thing was to learn their names. And she asked the first boy, "What's your name?" He said, "Jule, J-U-L-E. She stopped and proceeded to lecture. Said, "Now that's not your name, and I want it understood right now. Let's have no abbreviations and no nicknames whatsoever. Your name is Julius. And I want all the rest of it to so speak of it. And you tell the anybody ask you what their name is, Julius. Well, that was all right. Next boy came along. She said, son, what's your name? He said, Bilius. Of course, he didn't have an abbreviation about the thing. And thus it was. Now, I want to suggest the next thing. All preachers of the gospel are salesmen. That's our job. That's our business. I'm traveling over the country for the greatest firm the world has ever known, the Lord and Company, the Heavenly Association. I'm trying to sell the Church of the Lord to my fellows and the gospel of Christ to dying men. Well, of course, that's my purpose. Well, the finest men of this earth are engaged in salesmanship, and there are certain types that are wanted. And first of all, when a company thinks about employing a salesman, they want some fellow that has a neat, attractive appearance. And I stop slowly, go slowly enough for you to get points of that kind. They want him to be well-dressed, not gaudy, nor not trifling. They want him to wear a suit of clothes that fits, and not one that is two numbers or three numbers too small, trousers up halfway to his knees, and his coat scarcely meets them. Just like Abe Lincoln had to wear back when he was a boy, and they made fun of him. And one day in a social gathering, they asked him, Abe, how long do you think a fellow's legs ought to be? And he answered, characteristic of him, said, why, of course they ought to be long enough to reach from his body to the ground. And you can't beat that to save your life. But a salesman wants to have a splendid appearance. He wants to greet the customers with a smile and have something pleasant to say to them, and thus present an attractive, neat appearance before them. Don't go about young men shoddy, unkept. See that you're not advertising real estate under your nails, that your hair's combed, that there's no loose hairs on your coat, no dandruff all round about, and that your trousers are not baggy and greasy, and your tie over to one side, as sometimes they'll get in a Texas wind that blows them, but have a splendid appearance. Let all things be done decently and in order. Cultivate a spirit of that kind. I may be radical. I couldn't any more go to sleep at night if my right shoe was on the left side than nothing on earth. They've got to be just so-so, just right. And my trousers folded and possibly placed on the table under some books to save pressing expenses. And so many things of that kind. Now, that doesn't mean to be a dude nor a dudeen or anything of the kind. And I recognize Paul said, let no man think more highly of himself than he ought to think. And you can reverse that and still be in harmony with the Bible. Well, of course, you ought not to think more highly. You ought not to think more lowly either. And say, well, I don't care. Doesn't make any difference. Well, the world cares, by the way, sure as you live. And we gain our appearance and make our impression by the way we look when we meet folks for the first time, the second, and so on down the line. Now, that's not extravagant, but simply meekness in all regards. Boys, buy your box of shoe polish. Get your brush. Keep your shoes shine. Takes but a little while. Brush your clothes. And be neat in your appearance always. And not become filthy, dirty, greasy-like every time that you're seen. Of course, you don't want to be a stump sucker, that's what we call a horse, and I mean by that a cigarette sucker. I learned a long time ago and became disgusted when I heard some fellow lecture and tell what a cigarette was. Why, I said, it's a little piece of paper with some tobacco in it rolled up. It has fire at one end and a fool at the other. And I just decided I wouldn't do a thing of that kind. I think the greatest insult that goes over radio comes from a cigarette company. Hear it. It's a mark of distinction to have a carton of Philip Morris in your home. That's an insult to a decent home for anything of the kind. And of course you don't want to engage in things of that kind. My brother Cecil Douthat over here came from a section where they chawed tobacco. They didn't chew tobacco, but they chawed K-E-R-K-A, tobacco. Well, he never did engage in that, so far as I know, but has quit it, of course. Dirty, filthy habit. I used to think that a young man possibly could get by with chewing of tobacco because he still had the control of his muscle around the mouth. He could direct the stuff wherever he pleased. Well, I was out here in Texas once when Jimmy Allred was a candidate for governor, and I heard him speak up as chairman. And right then there was a speeding contest going on. You know, we have all kinds. I don't know whether they had a queen for it or not. Have to have a queen now for everything. Well, I got interested in a spitting contest. I'd never heard of such a thing. And I kept up with the paper, and finally the report came out that one fellow... He spat. He spat 13 feet and 4 inches. Well, I've seen plenty of boys way back yonder that could chew the stuff up and then put their things up this way and drive the 4-penny nail head center. But as we grow older, of course, that kind of stuff ought to be left off. Now, the old fellow loses control of this muscle around the mouth, and of course he wants to chew his tobacco. The purpose is to get the juice out, of course. And he can't handle it. And by and by his mouth gets so full that it oozes out. One part goes here, another there, and as the ambient parts, they say, so long, see you later. And they gather right down here. And then that drops off on the shirt that the wife has washed and starched and ironed, and he smears it and makes it worse than ever. Of course, it's time to quit. I used to sit and make hickory bark toothbrushes. Not for myself, but for others. And I've had them to curl up gracefully, that one, and then another curl, then on the other side. And then they chew a great big mop on it, ram it down in a big bottle of Brewster Snow, and then pull her wide open, pull her back, by the way, getting ready to meet the husband when he comes in, and just as soon kiss a cow almost as one of that kind. Why, of course, all of that should be laid aside with no part whatsoever for it. But a salesman not only needs to be neat in appearance, but let's think about it. He's got to know his ware. He's got to know his stuff that he's trying to sell. Now, the new automobiles for 1955, most of them have appeared. The first thing that the salesman does is to study this new automobile from bumper to bumper, by the way, learn every phase and feature about it and know the superior points and get well up on them. Well, he knows good and well, boys, that some fellow's going to object. I don't like this and I don't like that. And find fault. Now what? He's got to be prepared to answer the objections, to overcome the criticisms of it. And he's not a good salesman, and he can do that, by the way. And then what? Well, after he's explained everything to you and met all of your criticisms and objections, then what? Why, just step in and let's take a ride around the block. I want to demonstrate it to you. Had you ever thought about the application of that? Here I am trying to sell the gospel of God's Son to dying men and women. First, I've got to know the gospel. I've got to know the church of the Lord and wherein it differs from human affairs. That's my first task, young men, to study, to know what I'm trying to sell. And then I know good and well there are going to be objections aplenty. So what? I've got to study how to meet them. Now, in a school that said, oh, we just teach the Bible and teach the truth, yes, and you are lacking in the fulfilling of duty. Teach boys the opposition as well, what they may expect to meet and how to answer it. Why, I suggested the other night a little matter, namely that David prepared the material for the temple, a type of John the Baptist, that Solomon built the temple, a type of Christ, and the temple, a type of the church, but that Solomon built the temple before he died. And that's the fact. Now, the application of it. John the Baptist prepared the material for the church. Christ built the church. And some say, well, he had to build it before he died. And some preacher here who'd been preaching some time asked me to explain that to him. And I said, no, sir, you figure it out yourself. And be better for you. So get both sides of the question. When I teach the Bible, I teach as best I can the truth of it, and then suggest, young men, some fellow will come up on this verse with this quibble and with this objection. You've got to know how to meet it, and therefore help him to get prepared. And he goes out knowing both sides of it. You know, you want to demonstrate a thing both positively and negatively. Well, just like a boy one time that took the position that a grasshopper heard through its legs. And he was sold on that idea. And he said, now I'll demonstrate it. He got him a grasshopper and put him out the table there and tapped over here and said, now that board is a good sounding medium and the sound will travel here and strike his legs and he'll hop. And that proves it that way. Now he said, I'm going to show it from another angle. I'll pull his legs off and he won't hop. So he pulled his legs off and put him down there and tapped away, and he didn't hop. He said, there he is. Of course he hears through his legs. Be a good salesman. I heard of a merchant once that was a fine salesman. A woman's husband died. She went down to the store to buy a suit of clothes to bury him. And the salesman was such a good one that he talked her into buying a suit of clothes with two pairs of pants. And that's getting the thing done and accomplished. So, know your stuff, the gospel. Be filled with it. Study the objections. Be able to expose the error. And let the truth in contrast shine. And then, I don't know what church to tell you to suggest as a demonstration of what it means. Maybe anyone in Abilene. Now, I want to show you, demonstrate what I mean by the church and the gospel. Here are the facts about it, and there are the objection overcome. Now then, come around, let me show you. Let's go up to Firth and Highland. I know about where that is, but the only one. And look at that church. That's a demonstration of it. I just wonder, Bill Harper, if it'll bear investigation and demonstration along that line. But that's the way it ought to be. But I've talked to you long enough this morning.
And those are just some thoughts that I've had in mind.